Good evening, everyone. Happy Mahashivaratri. Start with the email message that is going out for Mahashivaratri. Kind of has our standard information. Mahashivaratri is Shiva's great night. It is the night before the new moon day in February, March. We observe it both as a discipline and a festivity, keeping a strict fast and all-night vigil, meditating, intoning Shiva's 1,008 names, singing his praise, chanting Sri Rudram, and bathing the Shiva Linga. Generally, Hindu festivals are near the time of the full moon. Such times are natural for seeking the blessings of the deity to enhance our family and professional activities, our outer life. Mahashivaratri, however, is at the time of the new moon, and it is a festival where the blessings of Lord Shiva are invoked for turning within and experiencing our inner self. In fact, the idea is to go as deeply within as possible. Gurudeva describes it as a time for being near the Vairagis, renunciates, as they strive to realize Parashiva, the self. First belief of the 12 beliefs of our Saivite creed speaks of this as well. Shiva's followers all believe that Lord Shiva is God, whose absolute being, Parashiva, transcends time, form, and space. The yogi silently exclaims, "It is not this, it is not that. Yea, such an inscrutable God is God Shiva, Om." Gurudeva wrote about the need to be able to move awareness nimbly for this realization to occur. The self, Parashiva, is so simple. You have to be so simple to realize the self. Not simple-minded, but so unattached. Awareness has to be able to move so nimbly through the mind, like a graceful deer going through the forest, so deftly through the mind that none of the sticky substance of the mind, so to speak, sticks onto awareness and holds it steadfast for a period of time. And only with that agility can you move awareness in quickly to the source, in on itself, until you come out having realized the self. It is an experience you come out of more than go into. End of the email. And then we have some text for merging with Shiva. Lesson 195. Talking about intuition. Here's a fine example of the use of intuition. You have often been in a situation in your own mind where you felt a subtle direct impulse from deep within you as to how you should proceed. Most probably, you denied it as fantasy and commenced in a logical way to fulfill your impulses and desires from previous patterns of experience, only to find that you would have traversed agonies and confusions had you followed the subtle impulse of direction, which was rejected to enhance established patterns of procedure. But I might add that that first impulse must have registered itself as cold and clear, direct and profound. Only if it did would it have indelibly imprinted itself within your memory patterns, clear and sharp, thus distinguishing itself clearly from all warm emotional feelings that appear to be reasonable and totally in line with the current pictures of the day. In current events, most people guide their lives on prior reasonable patterns. This knowledge is only prophetic. It has absolutely no relationship to the other courses of action entered into by intuitive decision, which in turn would encase man's individual awareness into the strong, dynamic, superconscious being that he ever was, is now, and always will be. Gurudeva has given us an excellent key for distinguishing if something's an intuition. Dreams, it's harder to tell. But when you're awake, it's easier to tell because you can judge it more clearly by comparing it to your normal way of thinking, which Gurudeva describes as warm emotional feelings. So an intuition, when you're awake, is cold and clear, direct and profound. And that's how you can distinguish it as being an intuition and just not a fancy or imagination. So intuition is very important in Saivasiddhanta. And as you know, Saivasiddhanta consists of the four padas, Charya, Kriya, Yoga, and Jnana. Each of the four padas is further divided into four sub-padas. And I could challenge you to rattle those off, but I won't. Charyancharya, Kriyancharya, Yoganancharya, Jnanancharya, and so forth. Thus you can see that each of the four padas has a jnana sub-pada. That's the point. Jnana refers to the experiential knowledge gained by the practices, and in Tamil is called anubhava unarchi. So that's what Gurudev is talking about, anubhava unarchi, intuition. Gurudeva gives this insightful statement about the jnana stage of each of the four padas. The first sadhana, therefore, is to always hold the overview and cling in your memory to the intuitive flashes that come as a result of your practices. These intuitive flashes come from deep within and are the only thing that should be remembered, for this is your jnana, your insightfulness, your own wisdom breaking through. In other words, in each of the four padas, Charya, Kriya, Yoga, and Jnana, there's different practices. So in Charya, we would have Charya, Kriya, and Yoga. And in practicing those, the wisdom that comes is the Jnana. And then in Kriya, we have another set of Charya, Kriya, and Yoga, and the wisdom that comes from those different practices, again, is Jnana, or Anubhava Unarchi. So Yogaswami was very strong on this. Three quotes. The book is within you. Turn over the leaves and study. It must come from within. Don't rely on book knowledge. Trust the self alone. Don't read books. It is in you. So that one I have to explain. What he's trying to say is, once you get to a certain point, you shouldn't just try and keep getting further knowledge out of books. Books can give you the basics. Yogaswami himself studied books when he was younger, but at a certain point he set the books aside and was looking for the book that was within him. And back to Gurudeva's text. Though we often use the terms unfolding intuitive faculties and developing intuition, they are only used in an effort to encourage the aspirant on the path to work within himself in subduing his intellect so that he can actually observe the already functioning totality of the intuitive area of the mind. In order to subdue the intellect, that conglomerate of thought patterns and established modes of procedure according to the culture of the day. Isn't that a beautiful phrase? Intellect. In order to subdue the intellect, that conglomerate of thought patterns and established modes of procedure according to the culture of the day, it is first quite necessary to inwardly observe how one's acquired intellect actually functions. Observation is a faculty of the intuitive area of the mind. And this particular aspect of observation that I have just described comes into usage only after regular periods of meditation have been maintained over a long period of time. Then we have a story, which are the best parts. This is Markandu Swami. For anyone who doesn't know who Markandu Swami is, Yogaswami passed on in 1964, and Gurudeva didn't start taking us to Sri Lanka until 1969, so obviously we didn't meet Yogaswami. But one of his brahmachari disciples, Markandu Swami in Jaffna. If you're doing sadhana, you're automatically a Swami. So he wasn't officially a Swami, but because he was doing sadhana, he was Markandu Swami. And we met him in his hermitage, very thin man with long white hair and beard. And he had one job, talk about Yoga Swami. That's all he did. Anyone who came, he would talk about Yoga Swami. So this is a story he told us. And we got this story in 1969, 1970, around that time. One afternoon at his hut, he described Yoga Swami's approach to dealing with thoughts during meditation. He said, Yoga Swami said, realize self by self. You want to read this book, that book, and all these books. The book of infinite knowledge is here, pointing to his chest. You'd better open your own book. The prescription he gave me to open that book is this. When you are in meditation, you watch the mind. Here and there, the mind is hopping. 1, 2, 3, 100. In a few seconds, the mind goes to 100 places. Let him be. You also watch very carefully. Here and there, this mind is running. Let him go anywhere. But if he goes to 100 places, you must follow him to 100 places. So that's the point, which I'll come back to. You must not miss even a single one. Follow him and note, he's going here, he's going there. You must not miss even a single one. That is the prescription Sadhguru Yogaswami gave me to open this inner book. He said, watch very attentively and learn to pick up things coming from within. These messages are very valuable. You can't value them. Realize self by self and open this inner book. Why don't you open your own book? Why don't you make use of it? What an easy path I am prescribing for you. This is a useful exercise in that many people who try and meditate are trying to stop thinking. And unless they've been meditating for a while, they find out that that's harder than it sounds. We can't manage to stop thinking for more than a minute or two, and then we start thinking again about what we're going to do tonight, what about tomorrow, what about this, what about that. So this is easier than stopping thinking. You just watch everything you're thinking about. And that's also a form of mind control. You don't let the mind go anywhere without knowing that it's gone there. You'd be able to afterwards say exactly where the mind went because you were watching it. So it's a concentration exercise, and as Markandu Swami says, if you do this, you start to get in touch with your intuition. So he's talking about the same thing that we were talking about previously. Then I have a second commentary, because Gurudeva's idea that is when many people hear about utilizing their intuition, they think it's something they're not utilizing. They think they have to do something for their intuition to be turned on. It's not there. I have to do something and then I'll have intuition. But that's not what Gurudeva said, right? We use the terms unfolding intuitive faculties and developing intuition. They are only used to encourage the aspirant on the path so we can actually observe the already functioning totality of the intuitive area of the mind. So the question is, if our intuition is already functioning, why aren't we aware of it? Very good question. Example I use for understanding that intuition is always functioning is soft music playing in the background. If the noises in the foreground are loud, then we are unable to hear the soft background music, right? But it is still there, even though we can't hear it. Our intuition is the same. The loud noises, of course, are thoughts. It's not something external to us. They need to be quieted so we can hear our already existing intuition. So that kind of makes it sound easier when we realize it's already functioning. It's just we have noise that covers it up, and it's very quiet. And we have Gurudeva's text again. True, our intuitive faculties do constantly mingle through thought sequences each day, But our ability to distinguish one from another is accrued only through regulated discipline of our individual power of awareness. Once an inkling of success comes in knowing intuition and how it differs from reasoning, emotional impulses, and pre-programmed patterns within the subconscious, the contest is won. Then and then only we must persist to sustain this knowledge and dive deeper into the inevitable, all the time losing the future and the past and loosening the reins of the intellect. The idea of losing the future and the past may not be clear if you haven't heard that before. And what Gurudeva means is we should not think about the past and future unnecessarily. A very interesting idea. Lots of people think about the past and think, that's totally good use of my time thinking about the past. But Gurudeva is saying, no, if you want to be good at meditation, don't just think about the past a lot. Only think about the past if there's a reason to. We're trying to understand something that happened a few years ago that we're still upset about. That's a reason to think about the past. So we don't think about the past and future unless there's a productive reason to go there. Otherwise, we keep the mind in the present moment. And we have the text again. When you begin to sense this changeless existence within you, your intuition begins to awaken, and if you function through the use of your intuition, you are able to clear many misunderstandings about the experiences of life. In this clarity, intuition is born. Right now, you perhaps think you are the mind. You may feel remote from your inner being, but ask yourself each time you think you have found yourself, will this change? You will find that every image you hold of yourself is subject to change. Even your soul or your superconscious mind is subject to change through evolution and therefore is impermanent. Only the self, the very core, is eternally the same, eternally real. Find your inner being through feeling. Realize it is closer than your hands or feet, closer to you even than your breath. Your mind will want to leave this consciousness as soon as you attain it, but gently guide your mind back through the channel of concentration until once again you become rejuvenated, uplifted in the awareness of that which has never changed. That is your very self, and that is God. My commentary is, the idea here is that part of you that exists right now is the changeless self, Parashiva. Part of you is the changeless source of all that exists. So again, it's already there. Different from the common perspective, I have to do something to realize the self, Parashiva. Because it's not there. Otherwise, I'd be aware of it. But that, again, is the wrong notion. It's there, just like intuition is there. You just haven't found it yet. But you couldn't exist without it. You couldn't be alive without Parashiva being at the core of your being, because it's the sustaining power, as we heard in the beautiful inspired talk by Gurudeva, the self-God. So that's the power which everything that's going on in your superconscious, intellect, emotions, physical body, it all draws on that power. So it's there all the time. We just have to figure out how to find it. Back to Gurudeva's text, Jnana Guru Yogaswami said, search without searching. This is an interesting idea. By this he meant that as long as we are searching for God in meditation, there are two, God and the seeker. He did not mean that we should stop looking for God, stop meditating or stop striving and live an ordinary life, or give up sadhana. He was saying that to deepen your meditation, while seated in the lotus posture doing pranayama, to deepen this state, stop looking and begin to realize that you are that which you are looking for. As long as there is searching, Parashiva has not been found, for searching is two and it is one. But you must keep searching until it is found. How to attain that? Sadguru Yogaswami said, stop looking and just be. Give up consciousness which was seeing and registering that which has been seen. Become like sound, nada, just be and merge into the ultimate quiet. When the disciple is on the brink of the absolute, the timeless Parashiva, two-ness disappears in the overpowering presence of Shiva, and consciousness is absorbed and annihilated in his transcendental being, which is non-different from the disciple's. However, if the disciple continues looking for this experience and thus in the act of his search solidifies himself in the sought-after experience as two different things, he becomes the obstacle and the problem to be eliminated. In the end, the great mystery is known as one, as two, as neither one nor two. So there's some useful information in Patanjali Yoga Sutras that relates to this idea of searching without searching. Second verse, chapter 1, Yogas Chitta Vritti Narodaha. Yoga is the restraint of mental activities. So this is talking about restraint. Our minds are generally busy in one type of mental activity or another. This is my commentary. We are remembering events from the past, thinking about current tasks, or theorizing about possible future events. Practices of yoga are designed to enable us to eliminate these mental activities altogether. Then my comment on that is, waves arise in the ocean, so waves of thought arise in the mind. Yoga is to control thoughts as they arise. And then we get this description of what type of restraint are we trying for. The kind we're not trying for when I do it. And with slides, I have a dog who's trying to rush forward, a leash, and a person holding back. So it's restraining the dog, right, with great effort. So if we're restraining our thoughts with great effort, that's the opposite of what we're trying to do. But what are we trying to do? On the highest level, you do not have to control even the mind, because to control the mind, there must be a second. There will come a time when the mind becomes quiet by itself. And one last quote. Now we don't control the mind. We remain summa, still, with a controlled mind. So we're trying to just be still in an effortless way, rather than restraining these thoughts that are like an energetic, medium-sized dog. Thank you very much. Om. Om.